Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 160, Open Temple. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And this is the final interview in our series on creativity that we put together in collaboration with the Council of American Jewish Museums. The Creative Challenge was the subject of the Council of American Jewish Museums' annual conference, which was held last weekend in Los Angeles, California. It was a real honor for me to lead a panel discussion with the first three guests in this series, Aaron Henney, Yishai Husidman, and Ivy Barsky, as the opening plenary panel of the conference. We had a really interesting conversation deepening the explorations that we did on the podcast, and we look forward to releasing that audio in just a few days. In this series so far, we've talked to four people whose creativity manifests through the use of what we might look at as four different mediums of art. Aaron Henney works with theater. Yishai Husidman works with paint. Jonathan Safran Foer works with the novel. And Ivy Barsky works with the museum itself. Today's guest, Lori Schneidy Shapiro, is a creative who is using Judaism itself as the medium of her art. She is the founding rabbi and artistic director of The Open Temple in Venice, California. You could think of The Open Temple as sort of a synagogue-adjacent type of activity. On their website, they describe themselves as seeking to re-enchant Judaism through ritual space, the creative arts, and multimedia with a 21st century vibe. The Open Temple has been getting a lot of attention in the LA area in the last year, and nationally as well. They were selected to be one of the members of the second cohort of the Open Door Project. About a year ago, we talked to all the members of the first cohort of that project, which you might remember is a project sponsored by Moshe House to cultivate experiments like this in the what we might think of as the Jewish spiritual space. We'll talk with Lori Schneidy Shapiro about some of her personal background, but prior to becoming a rabbi, she worked as the director of Jewish life and senior consultant for interfaith relations and outreach at the University of Southern California's Hillel. She calls her rabbinate transdenominational, and she has actually studied at three different rabbinical seminaries and graduated from two. And now, in addition to being a rabbi, she's also studying to be a spiritual director with the Yedidya Center for Spiritual Direction. So, Lori Schneidy Shapiro, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
It's awesome to be here.
I wanted to start out in a way that's a little bit different from how we usually start out, because before we describe what Open Temple is and what it does, I think it would be really helpful to talk about the why. What led you to create Open Temple? What was the gap, the lack that you were responding to as you understood it?
I really think it ostensibly comes from my personal journey. I am the identifiable pew periphery. I really represent in the way that I grew up, in the way that I had no identifiable Jewish identity, that I my whole journey in and of itself really represents what it is to know nothing about Jewish life, to be unaffiliated, disaffiliated, insecure about Jewish identity because I knew not of what it was. But it really came from, I say I'm like the first millennial. I had a personal emerging adulthood experience that when I came out the other side, I was a rabbi. So Open Temple is really a personal labor of love, but it also kind of trends at a time where this is an identifiable need of the Jewish community, meaning reaching unaffiliated, disaffiliated Jews on the periphery, perhaps people who grew up with some Jewish identity but fell away, or people who are very committed to Jewish identity but wanting something that has a little bit more of an aesthetic and an intellectual bent to it.
So tell us a little bit about that millennial journey in which you go in one way and come out a rabbi. I'd like to hear more about that.
I grew up in theater. So my ritual space growing up in suburban Long Island was being in a black box theater on the Lower East Side. And I knew nothing about Shabbat, or I didn't know an Aleph from a Shin, but I lived in the five towns of Long Island. So Shabbat passed by my door every Friday night and every Saturday morning, waiting for me to meet her and greet her and join. And when I was in college, I started at Tisch and NYU. And when I showed up at orientation, I realized in my soul, oh my God, I made a mistake. Prior to going to college, I had spent a summer in junior year of high school in India and experienced things that really kind of gave me, I say, it circumcised my eyes and my heart. So the idea of going forward in a life of theater no longer, it was discordant with what my values, my values shifted forever. And so when I showed up at orientation at Tisch, I was like, oh my God, I made a mistake. And I immediately pivoted and I applied for Barnard and I transferred mid-year up to Barnard and I became an English major and I just studied 18th century literature and astronomy and women's studies and just really fed my mind and cultivated my mind to go past and challenge itself past the upbringing I had been given. And then when I was out of college, I made a promise to myself that I was going to go around the world. So I started my journey around the world. And I, a few months into my journey, about 3 or 4 months, I was in the Costa del Sol of Spain studying transcendental meditation. And Pilar DeFranco was my mentor. And every time I would go into the meditation and I would emerge, we would discuss it. I had first learned TM a year before in India. So I had wanted to kind of, master it a little more. And when I would emerge from it, Pilar would ask me what my experience was like. And I kept saying, I keep having images of Hasidic Jewish men. And after a few days of this recurring image coming to me, we decided that perhaps I should do something about it. So within 6 weeks, I went via ship to Italy and Greece and the Greek islands and Cyprus. And I landed in the port of Haifa with a backpack on my back, looking at this endless blue sky. And I'll never forget walking off the ship onto the ground of Israel. I knew nothing about Israel except the Persian Gulf War, which had happened when I was in college. And a young man on the ship said to me he was going to kibbutz. So I was like, oh, maybe I could go there and learn about Judaism. So I schlepped down with him to go to En Gedi, and we changed buses at Jerusalem. Had I been alone, I would have gone to Tel Aviv because that's all I knew from CNN. But we changed buses at Jerusalem, and a young woman with a tichel and a pamphlet in her hand handed it to me and said, come to Heritage House for Shabbat. And my response was, love to go into kibbutz to learn about Judaism. And so I took my backpack, went alone to a bus stop. It was like so cinematic. Imagine like a little skinny 22-year-old just figures out she's Jewish girl. And I walk into Heritage House and everyone was lighting Shabbat candles and rushing out to the kotel. So I follow them down. I lay down my backpack. People tell me to hurry. I walk through the old city for the first time. And I work my way down to the kotel. And there's a man who everyone knows, Jeff Seidel. Famously, Jeff Seidel is waiting there, really assigning people Shabbat dinners and Shabbat experiences to have. I tell him I'm a vegan. So he says, I've got this great guy. He's a vegan. You'll go to him. So I go to this man's house. It's overlooking the old city. And on his Shabbat table, he has all of these photocopied sheets of Eshet Chayil, a woman of valor. So he has us read it. At the time, it was the first time I'd ever seen this text. And I read it. And I'm straight out of Barnard, you know. And I learn that this guy, you know, has a wife. And she does his laundry. And she cooks for him and cleans for him. And he asks us, what is righteous about her? And my response is, what is righteous about her? This woman is oppressed. Like, what do you mean she's righteous? And the escalation occurs and the man says to me, you know, how old are you? Where's your husband? What do you do for a living? And it escalates so much that I stand up crying and I say, I know you're doing this to incite me to learn about Judaism, but I assure you, I will do it not because of you, but to spite you. And I leave his house before his fabulous dessert, crying with like a full, like, snot-nosed traveler's cold, walking through the streets of the old city. And I notice that there are little window boxes and there are Shabbos candles, but there are also 9 candles following them. And I realized it was the first night of Hanukkah. So Hanukkah really became a deep dedication of my Jewish journey, of me going from someone on the periphery to someone who begins Jewish literacy.
Thank you, first off, for giving us that background, but now would be good to jump into Open Temple. And A, I wanna hold Open Temple in our minds as part of this series of conversations we're having about creativity. And when I was on your website, when I was on the Open Temple website, it just felt more and more appropriate that we were talking to you now in this context, surrounded by these other episodes that we've had where we're talking to artists, etc. And in particular, there was one, I don't know, it was a couple sentences on your site that I'm actually going to read that just struck me as very beautiful. And I wanted to ask you about it as sort of an introduction to what is this whole Open Temple project that you do. And you say the following, and it's a few questions. What if creative spiritual practice was a part of Jewish education? If the paintbrush, dance shoe, sense of humor, yoga mat, and drum kit were as integral a part of Jewish education as a tallit, a prayer shawl, a siddur, a prayer book, and Hebrew letters? I was really, inspired by that idea, but I wanted to ask, I have a sense of what it could mean, but I want to know, like, what does it mean for you to talk about why a paintbrush, a dance shoe, etc. would be part of Jewish education? And how more broadly does that represent what Open Temple is striving to do?
It was in Safat that I was able to integrate the idea of what the Jewish concept of Habore, the creator, ex nihilo, like something from nothing, comes from, and then go back into my life in theater, where I would enter into, as Peter Brook says, an empty space. And from that experience of an empty space, revelation happens. And so I think Torah really is a blueprint for us to become creators in our lives. We're told in the book of Bereshit, we're created b'tzelem Elohim. We're said in the image of God, but really it's almost like in the silhouette of God. And that in this silhouette, we are able to have all of these kind of shadow puppetry, shadow plays that are the manifestations of the curiosities, the dreams, the imaginings of within. Open Temple and its Arts 36 program was conceived really from that young woman that I once was 20 years ago, who dreamt of someone taking Judaism and learning through the arts, just as I did in Sfat. And so when I think of Open Temple, I think what I was trying to do on a very personal experience was take Sherei Bina, which is the midrash I was at, which means gates of feminine wisdom, and kind of have this house kind of fall, like Dorothy's house into Oz, fall into Venice. And that's what Open Temple is. It's taking a little piece of Sfat, or the more spiritual center of Jerusalem where people live outside of the old city, Nachlaot, and bring it into Venice, California, which has in and of itself a really rich arts and cultures history.
We've talked a lot about there being people who are making the kind of art that we traditionally think of as art, painting, novel writing, singing, on Jewish themes. And that's a form of Jewish art. And when you talk about the ballet slipper and the paintbrush, et cetera, being part of it, you know, one could imagine that that's what we're really getting at. And the other possibility, and I think it's both, but I'd love for you to talk about both, is that Judaism itself is the medium of our art, that we have been sort of taught to look at Judaism from a preservationist eye, from a conserving perspective that says this is things that we have been given and it is on us to continue to do them, as opposed to the mentality of an artist who, I think, any material that is put in front of an artist, they say, my job is to reshape it. That's what I do. And so I'm curious about how somebody who comes from an arts background, who thinks of themselves as an artist, and who also is very conscious of doing this kind of refashioning of the material of Judaism, you know, thinks about these big questions, and could you help us and our listeners think about them?
I did not have those stigmas, I'll call them stigmas, or definitions upon me when I started my Jewish journey. And I named that because when I came into my Jewish life, I had a background of knowing of the divinity of ritual space, of the aesthetic of dance, of painting, of art. Then I come into Safat, where I'm able to, yes, and bring it with me. And what I was really able to synthesize was a very, as I said, a personal emerging adulthood journey where I was connecting these ideas on my own based on my reading, based on my curiosities, and then bringing it to Jewish life. So for me, a ballet slipper or a tap shoe or a paintbrush or a yoga studio are all ritual spaces. And again, then I go into a Jewish ritual space, whether it's a synagogue, whether it's a chapel, whether it's a Shiva house. And I see again an empty space where people are engaged in ritual practice. What then brought it so deeply home for me, again, is that emerging adulthood journey, because life makes more sense when we know from whence we came. And so as I was piecing together my own identity as a child of an intermarried family, I was discovering that everything I had learned in my own personal curiosities as a young girl and as a teenager folded beautifully into the aesthetic of mitzvot and Judaism.
There's a lot of folks out there who I think have an experience, whether it is in, say, India or in Israel or somewhere, that feels spiritually new and exciting and invigorating, but not everybody takes the step that you did. Sure, going and becoming sort of an official kind of Jewish leader, but also starting an organization out of it. So what did that look like? And in what ways does this organization seek to embody some of these experiences that you've had and ideas that you've come to hold dear?
In telling the story of Open Temple, it really has to be how I am invested in this community. I got married, I got pregnant, I was still working at USC, I was schlepping back and forth to downtown. And one day when I was pregnant, driving downtown, I remember I stopped at a red light and I said, there's no way I'm gonna do this while I have a kid, because it's 45 minutes away from my home. And that's not the kind of mom I wanna be. And that day I drove home and I said to my husband, how would you feel if I community organized a community for Venice? Now, it just so happens that my husband's family is very involved in the Jewish community. So saying to them, hey, how do you feel about me starting another new Jewish spiritual startup in LA? It's like they were founders of the Breed Street Synagogue. They were founders of Beit Tshuva. They were founders of what was then Valley Jewish Center, which is now Adat Ariel. They've created a lot of Jewish institutions here. So it was the right fit and they said, go for it. So I took out a kiosk at a local street fair and I collected 125 names. By then I had given birth to my daughter and I was on playgrounds and I collected names and numbers there. And I just started an aggressive listening campaign where I data gathered. And concurrent to that, I became a fellow with the Clergy Leadership Incubator, which was with Sid Schwartz and Erwin Kula at the time. And we were mentored through adaptive leadership and being change agents in the Jewish world. And it was really a human-centered design endeavor. And from that, I held our first Hanukkah event, and it was awful. It was abysmal. And I ended up going home that night, looking in the mirror saying, thank God I'm 41 and I'm not 21. We're going to make this happen, learn from my mistakes. And from there, we created, for the first year, 18 happenings. I called them low-hanging fruit. And they were everything from a high holidays experience to a Hanukkah experience that then worked, based on community need, me identifying community opportunity. And those 18 experiences the first year then became 36 experiences in the next year. And that led to us getting our first property, which is Open Temple House. When I created Open Temple House, it was really important that it have this feeling of this artistic space. As I said earlier, it is like a piece of Safat or Nachlaot landed in Venice. The first thing I did is I created a music studio, which I'm in right now, Soul Journey Studios. I'm coming to you from Soul Journey Studios right now. And this is a place where we engage young Jewish artists. We also have an atelier right next door to here. And that's a studio where we have a loom. And the children learn about Torah through weaving. They learn about the woven tales of the Talmud. They also have an art studio where one of our board members is married to a CalArts professor, Dave Lebo, and he's taught our students as well. Upstairs, we have a meditation room where the students do a little social behavioral deep dive into Musar, into personal wellness. And then we're on the campus of a performing arts center, Electric Lodge. And the Electric Lodge has a dance studio where every Shabbat we begin with Israeli dance. We also begin with perhaps improv if it's before Purim, and then the improv becomes some sort of presentation or disruption in our service that is a counterpoint to what we're doing in our tefillah, in our prayer. And then we also have a classroom and a 99-seat black box theater. And this campus, this entire space, becomes the space upon which we get to come to life through engaging in Judaism.
One way to frame what you're doing, as you did, is that there was a community, Venice, California, that didn't really have the kind of Jewish community that was working for a certain set of people, and you created that. And that's sort of one way to tell the story. Another way to tell the story, though, is that what you're creating is something profoundly different and profoundly responsive to the needs of a certain kind of person who I think that you identified with both from your own background and from your own orientation as an artist. And I'd love to hear more about that. You know, I'd be interested in now that you're up and running and sort of seeing what is working, what is not working, what insight that's giving you on the unmet needs of Jews out there. And specifically, you know, I'm curious if what we're dealing with is a version of a marketing problem, right? Which says like Judaism is doing good, but we just have to make it able to be experienced in a new way that works better. Or is what we're seeing a kind of a product problem where we're saying like, no, actually Judaism isn't working and needs to be, you know, sort of rebooted, remixed, or something else in between. And I'm curious what your take on it is today, having been operating for a while.
Yeah, Dan, I think it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I, at Open Temple, am not doing this alone. It really is a dynamic of all of us coming together. I created an empty space for people to be drawn towards with certain marketing outreach, and now they find us. And who finds us? People who are poets, people who are divine rhymers, do a kind of beatbox to tefillot, to prayers, musicians, actors, improv artists, Israeli dancers. They're all finding us together. And it's because I gave a welcoming invitation as well as a method to fold it into ritual space in ways that bring us to life. And what we're doing is we're creating a dramatic experience of the moment where we all can show up. And we do it through aesthetic prompts, whether the prompt is a contrafaction of an ancient Hebrew prayer with a Madonna song, or if it's a experience of a soul journey where one person comes up and shares their soul and their life story. People are just bringing their offerings. And all that we did is we invited them into the space. And it's not just me anymore. There's a dynamic and invested board as well as core of people that are doing this as well. Everyone has this aesthetic inside of them that they could give that is their own. And at Open Temple, we let people, we invite them. It's a shame-free, love-filled space for people to just be and belong.
So can we put a little bit more even meat on those bones and say, what actually happens when I show up at Open Temple?
I'm going to give you an example from Yom Kippur. So at Yom Kippur one year, you walked in and the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil was playing. And then when it's over, I asked everyone, why would we begin Yom Kippur with that song? A part of what I want everyone to understand is that on this day, Yom Kippur, we will ask expiation from the devil. And we will give an offering called Azazel to the Azazel, ancient Near Eastern demonic god, right? And that is in Leviticus. It is in our Torah portion that we will read today. And we're going to revisit this when we get there. And we go through the service. We're reading the Torah. And I stop it. And I'm like, how many people actually know what's being said? And no one knows what's being chanted. So I crack open the book. I sit down and said, let's read it. And we go through the readings in Parshat Achrimot, you know, after the death of Nadav and Avihu, Aaron's sons. And we see how Aaron is asked to bring like this superhuman offering of a bull and a ram and two goats, right? After he's in the Shiva of his sons being killed by God. Can you imagine? It's really an unbelievable task. In the midst of his mourning that he has to do this. And he goes and he brings them. And then we remember how these two goats, one goes to God, and one then is going to be sent off into the wilderness to fend for itself as an offering to Azazel. And I identify Azazel again as a demonic goat god of the ancient Near East. And in that moment, I ask everyone, what in our human behavior would require us to give expiation to the devil? And in that moment, images from Charlottesville with the torches and the men chanting, Jews won't replace us, came on the screen, because we use a screen at every service. And they saw kind of like those images, those KKK-like images of the night. And in that moment, a man rose from the congregation and said, that was me. And I said, excuse me. He says, that was me. I was one of those people. And I had planted him there. He was from an organization called Life After Hate. And he came there to share his story, show how he's getting rid of his anti-Semitic tattoos. And he was there to ask forgiveness. And the idea behind it is that there is a humanity in the other, that the other is just another side of us. And if we could just open our hearts to the potential of people doing real tshuva, of real turning, we can bridge what we see in our country today as an unbridgeable gap.
Okay. There's about 100 little things that you mentioned, each of which deserves like 45 minutes of a podcast episode. But one of them is going to be the next question. Real quick, you said, well, we've got to screen at every service. Next point, repentance, et cetera. That's an important thing. And you know, for us, since we're always talking about the role of various forms of digital technology and et cetera, in Jewish life, like that's worth dwelling on. And I want to actually name specifically that wasn't your point. Like, you talked about the screen as a means of getting to all sorts of other deeper things. So I'd love to ask you, sort of, on the one hand, why do you have a screen at every service? Because I think it'd be a mistake to assume you just have it because, you know, it's cool or it's like modern or whatever. I'm sure that's not it. And then step B is, what would you say to people who either haven't seen what that looks like or might be skeptical about what that looks like? How would you communicate with such a listener or such a person and get them thinking about how this could really be a sacred form of community, of ritual, of whatever it serves in your community?
Digital arts are a legitimate form of art. People in, you know, Venice in and of itself is going through an adaptive change, and people in Venice who are old timers feel staunchly that it's changed and that it's lost something. And a part of my argument is, first, I need to hold space for you to mourn what was, because change is upon us. And second, I welcome you to embrace arts, which are no longer pastels and oil paints and acrylics, but digital arts. Venice over the past few years was renamed Silicon Beach because this digital arts nexus has arisen here, and it's fabulous and fascinating and filled with young people doing some of the most creative things on earth. And the other thing that I say is, Open Temple is not for everyone. So there are going to be people who self-select to come here, and equally there will be people who never come back. And that is so okay, because I can say, hey, go to the conservative synagogue down the block. It's beautiful, and go and enjoy what they have. However, with the screen or digital arts in and of itself, it's another invitation into integration of modern day aesthetics. And think about it, you know, whether it was the late medievalist or early medievalist use of Kalam, which was a methodology of Islamic thought, or whether it was the use of acrostic, which was a form of prayer that was adopted from Christianity. We always found and integrated in Kel Heinu as a German beer girl song. You know, we were always into a place of religious syncretism, a place where we interacted with the cultures or the religions around us. And so we need to ask those questions today. How am I being an American Jew in 2019, 57, 79? And a part of my answer to that question is through digital arts media. Our screen is essential in this service, in the sense it becomes another vehicle of transcendence. It elevates our prayers. It brings us together. It allows us to have insight through different embedded videos that we'll show. It allowed me for the Une Tani Tokef prayer, which began with that famous Kibbutznik song, "It's so beautiful, Une Tani Tokef," that famous one, that then in the middle of it stopped, and they saw a heartbeat monitor, and they watched for a full minute as this heart beeped and then failed in the prayer where they're asked to consider their own death. And what followed then was an amazing Queen song. Would we die by fire? Would we die by water? And we turned it into a rap over this Queen song of Another One Bites the Dust. I say that because all that I'm doing is what my ancestors were doing in Eastern Europe or in Iraq when they were taking the aesthetics that surrounded them and then allowing Judaism to refract through it. That's really it.
But I think it's an interesting example, actually, to stay on this topic of Une Tani Tokef, which a lot of us, I think, know as the prayer that's about who by fire and who by water. And what's interesting, that's what I wanted to ask about. The thing is that when Leonard Cohen wrote Who by Fire, it's obviously based on Unetanetokhev, but most people don't consider it a prayer, don't consider it liturgy. Now, some synagogues use it that way, but most people considered it a song of, you know, that was based on liturgy. What's interesting to me about the move that you're making is that you're saying we can do exactly what Leonard Cohen was doing with Who by Fire, and we're going to create this rap to the beat of Another One Bites the Dust. And it is part of the prayer. It is the prayer. And I guess, like, it's the chutzpah of that move that Leonard Cohen didn't have, but that you have. And I mean, I always mean chutzpah only in the best way. That feels to me like it's something new in Jewish spaces, right? That what Leonard Cohen did, that he had to do it sort of functionally outside of formal Jewish spaces of worship, whereas you're able to do that within. And I'm interested in your reflection on that.
I don't think Cohen was doing anything chutzpah-dict. I think he actually was hearkening back, as I said, to what was a Jewish tradition, which is folding in the culture that surrounds us into Jewish liturgy. In his case, he was taking the Unetanetokhev and he was writing his style of song, which he had already created an aesthetic of it. So I think he was quite Jewish in what he did. And I think, remember, you know, we're talking in this post-Holocaust time. And what I say about the Holocaust, because I was a little Jewish girl growing up in New York, and I remember in the 70s going up to the Catskills. And what I said about the Catskills in the 70s is, like, it was the end of the Catskills. And people were still going there for 40 years after the Shoah to sit shiva. Like, that's what they did. They went up to these places and they sat there and they drank coffee and you'd hear Yiddish and they'd have tattoos on their arms and they were just sitting in the wreckage. And a part of that was this somber darkness of what Jewish identity was. And with the turning of the millennia, I'd like to think that now it's a millennia away from us, the Shoah. And so we can kind of dwell in this renaissance and renewal of Judaism. And I think that that's what's going on, that we shouldn't forget the Shoah, but it was a millennia ago. And so we can move to a place of levity again and lightness of being. And I think that that's a bit of what's happening. There are things sprouting up throughout the country, but I can say that I do perceive that LA is particularly progressive. And there are literally dozens of communities that are doing radical departures of traditional Judaism. We're not the only one.
So in a few ways, this feels like my cue, this conversation about the Catskills. I don't think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but my family's roots are actually in the Catskills, my mom's side of the family. My mom grew up in the Catskills, so many people talk about sort of visiting there in the summers, but my mom lived there the whole year round. And I hope that this will lead logically to the question I want to ask. I think it will. Her father and mother and her grandfather even all lived in the Catskills. Initially, her grandfather came there. And I bring it up for a couple of reasons. One is that all of my mom, not all, the vast majority of my mom's family social circle, all of the people in town, all the people that they spent time with were Jews. But interestingly, or maybe even not that interesting, maybe it's just sort of intuitive, they were Jews, but they were just not at all really engaged with religious tradition. My great-grandfather, my mom's grandfather, had been very, very deeply schooled in the Talmud, but sort of discarded it actively and was a socialist, and so was my grandfather, and, you know, all of those pieces in play. And I say this for a couple of reasons. One is that we're talking about LA, and I want to talk a little bit about pop culture and Judaism. I mean, you've alluded to this with Queen songs and all of the, and Leonard Cohen and all these ways that pop culture is fusing its way into Judaism. And I want to bring it up precisely because that wasn't what was happening in the Catskills for my mom's side of the family. Not, I mean, they were just as deeply Jewish, and in some metrics, maybe you could say they were more deeply Jewish, you know, spending all their time with Jewish people than I am. But I feel like they were not doing this blurring work of pop culture and Judaism. They saw Judaism, like the religion, whatever, as sort of antiquated and they didn't do all that much of it. But at the same time, they were deeply Jewish in this secular sense. That's modeled by many people today. But I also think what's modeled today and what we see in a show like Transparent, for example, we see in a show like Transparent, which is deeply Los Angeles and based in Los Angeles, there's a rabbi who's a main character. There's people who are thinking about Jewish identity and all sorts of ways in which ritual pops up. And I contrast that to a show like, say, Seinfeld, which I think, funny enough, is actually a better reflection of many of my mom's side of the family, A, because it's in New York, but B, because they weren't, you know, building Jewish ritual into the show. It was just sort of the subtext was very clearly Jewish in all sorts of ways. And I'm curious to think about and talk about that contrast. Like, is there something happening in Los Angeles in particular that is yielding shows like Transparent, is helping people to blur the spheres of pop culture and Judaism? And like, what is it that's different about it from our past?
I think it's Reboot. Reboot's an organization that they would tap people in Hollywood in the late 90s, early 2000s, and they would whisk them off to Park City, and they would work with rabbis like Sharon Brous, and they'd do Jewish learning, and they'd create learning opportunities and circles of practice to follow their immersive experience. And I think that's I know how Jill Soloway got tapped, and I think it had impact. It had impact of that was seen on MTV and VH1. It was seen in TV shows. And I think that's a little bit of the trickle-down effect of some of this behind-the-scenes engagement that was happening with philanthropic dollars. And I think it's quite brilliant because it has had a trickle-down effect and then led to a curiosity. There's like a beautiful kind of matrix that you can see from people in Hollywood writing, what's our greatest export in America, pop culture. And then it finding that young person that's going on Birthright, illuminating or arousing in them a curiosity they never had before. And I think that is how you get a Transparent, making people want to talk about Israel, making people want to talk about Judaism in a different way.
I'm connecting this also to the thinking that we're doing about the role of museums, how we often think about a museum as a place where we go to look at artifacts from the past. And then the question is like, what do we do with them? And one way to think about it is like, how do we reorient the museum experience to be that, yeah, I'm going to experience the artifacts of the past, but it's so that I can master them and now create something new. And or I also think of like the Science Museum, which is a place where we don't go to see the artifacts of the past. We go in a way to be invited into this other world that we don't always experience every day and be invited to be a participant and a creator in it. And it feels like in a certain way, when you describe what's going on in Open Temples, in a way, it's triggering for me that sense of what it would feel like to be in a Jewish science museum.
So there is this idea of this calcified or ossified presence in a museum. And I think one of the things happening quite dynamically and excitingly, especially as millennials are becoming curators more and more, is where we're revivifying and kind of redefining what museum is. You know, MoMA is re-envisioning its entire arts gallery, it's permanent collection. And so a part of that is really asking the question, what is the role of museum and does it need a new name? Because we are looking to have, I think museums are more like temples. I think that they're ritual spaces where things happen. When I saw Marina Abramović at MoMA sitting and having her I Thou moment, I really saw it as an embodiment of the work of Martin Buber. I think that museums are really places to come to life, and that's why people flock to them, because we want to feel something. And I think in 21st century spiritual communities, people want to feel something again. We don't need to be so austere anymore that we, as I said, as Jews left in the 20th century. And so how it kind of trickles down into Judaism, I love the image of a science center. Remember, science museums are usually called science centers because they have already redefined themselves outside of that restriction or that narrowness of museum. So I think that there is an alchemy happening, and I think Open Temple captures that alchemy. However, I want to go back to the beginning of your question, the ratio of it, which spoke about whether the idea of the temple or the tension between the temple and rabbinic Judaism, and how when the temple was lost, rabbinic Judaism or words replaced it. And I think, again, there was an aesthetic to those words. You know, what differentiated the ancient Near Eastern God of the Israelites from all other gods is our God wrote. And not only did our God write, our God wrote and exposed itself through these words, Ehyeh asher ehyeh, I will be that I will be. So God revealed God's self to Moses as the creative process, becoming. It's the creative process where we experience revelation. And I think both museums and ritual spaces are places where all of us go. There are modern day Sinais. That's why so many synagogues are called Mount Sinai. We're to go there and have an experience of theophany, an experience of God revealing God's self to us.
So we are arcing to the close of the episode. And as we close, just is there anything that you'd want to leave our listeners with as they move on to whatever's next after they put their earbuds aside, walk out of their car, wherever they're listening to this episode?
I truly feel that the world could not continue if we were not to be aligned with it. And so a place like Open Temple exists to invite people to come in and say, what small contributions do you have to make? Because most of us are not meant to be Martin Luther King Jr. And yet the world could not continue to go day to day without each and every one of us finding the very thing that we're supposed to put forward. So I think, you know, it's a radically different way to think of Tikkun Olam, that each of us has a purpose, and to find a spiritual placement or a spiritual community that allows us to align with our purpose and to really live lives with dignity and connectedness, and to then emerge from that experience that we have in a spiritual community and to know that we are leading the lives that we are supposed to lead is the point of why we have spiritual community. So I just give a blessing that each and every one of us awaken every day with our moda anila fanecha, our prayer of gratitude, to say, I have a purpose and I am here for an essential reason without which the world cannot continue.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you guys. You're awesome.
And you know who else is awesome? Our listeners. You're really awesome. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. And if you did, our other episodes on creativity and preservation and museums and all the ways that they intersect. We hope you've enjoyed this unit of episodes, and we hope that you'll listen into our bonus episode featuring a variety of our past guests, our recent past guests, in conversation with one another. So thank you. And we want to close out this episode, as we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, email us. Please, please email us. We love your ideas and comments and questions and concerns and frustrations and whatever you want to send our way. You can hit us up at dan@judaismunbound.com and or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we like to make is that any amount of financial support you're able to spare for us is greatly, greatly appreciated. And you can send a donation our way at judaismunbound.com/donate through either a once a month recurring gift or a one-time donation. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.